Days. And I think most people who are not aware of the fact that they should take it a little easier in those times are unconsciously lashing out their own shadow projections in different ways. I'm sure you've been able to observe it in your surrounding as well. It's interesting to watch. Analyzing things from different perspectives gives us a wider lens through which we can see a bigger picture. That is what this program is about. We consider it to be essential in these times. You can get much more of that at redeyescreations.com. Radio, TV, commentary, news, and much more. Today we're talking to Paul Levy, who's been with us two times before, last time in 08. Paul early on pursued a career in art, and in 1981, due to an intense personal trauma, he had a life-changing spiritual awakening, in which he began to recognize the dreamlike nature of reality. During the first year of his spiritual emergence, Paul was hospitalized a number of times and he was told he was having a severe psychotic break from reality. Fortunately, he was able to extricate himself from the medical and psychiatric establishment that did not realize that he was taking part in a mystical awakening, a shamanic initiation process. After the trauma of his shamanic breakdown or breakthrough, he became a certified art teacher. Due to his intense interest in the work of Carl Jung, by the end of the decade, he found himself the manager of the C.G. Jung Foundation book service in New York. Paul has developed a unique and creative vehicle to introduce people to the dreamlike nature of reality that he calls the dreaming up process, which is based on the realization that the same dreaming mind that dreams our dreams at night is dreaming our life. Paul says our species is clearly in the middle of a mass psychic epidemic, which he calls malignant egophrenia, and Native American calls Wetiko psychosis. There is a psycho-spiritual disease of the soul, whose origin is within ourselves, that has the potential to either destroy our species or wake us up, depending on whether or not we recognize what it is revealing to us. Keep on listening for more. Welcome back, Paul. Long time since we last spoke, actually back in 2007, but it's good to have you back with us once again. Thank you, first of all, for coming on and taking the time talking with us here today, Paul.
Oh, I'm just so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. This is going to be interesting. It was interesting we had you back in 2007 as well and talked about your first book at that time, The Madness of George W. Bush, a reflection of a collective psychosis, really important stuff when it comes to some of the things pertaining to looking inward instead of just constantly outward, of course. And I guess I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of the basics here in the beginning about your new book, Wetiko.
Sure.
And how it differs or if it basically takes on from your first book, Paul.
Sure. Well, yeah, one of the main differences is that it's not focusing on Bush, which I'm very grateful, for. But it very much has to do with that book on Bush, because basically in that first book, I actually gave a name to this non-local disease of the soul that I was actually having the recognition of. It was informing the whole field, the whole body politic, and it was being, in a way, you could say, incarnated in the figure of Bush. And I gave it the name malignant egophrenia, ME disease, me disease for short. Because it's really pointing at, it's at some sort of, like, it's this misidentification of who we're imagining we are. And, you know, when the book came out, then I became more familiar. Indigenous cultures were tracking the exact same disease, and they had a whole mythology around it. And so with the new book that I wrote, I actually, in a way, am just translating the sort of the Native American wisdom traditions, their perspective on Wetiko or Wedeco, however one says it, it really varies, but how that's actually the exact same thing that I was trying to point at with oligonegophrenia, and that it actually pervades the whole field, and it's something that's informing, you know, that has to do with all of us, that, you know, there's not any of us who are free of it. And it's just an incredibly interesting contemplation when you actually discover it's kind of like this mind parasite, or like, I have a lot of metaphors for it. We can talk about that as we unfold this discussion. But it's, I guess the thing I want to say that really was the most interesting for me was that in this particular sort of psycho-spiritual disease of the soul that was in my first book that I wrote about in Bush, and then in the current book, I had the realization, oh, wow, encoded in the disease is actually, it's actually potentially helping us to wake up to who we are. But if we don't have the recognition in a way of what it's showing us, then it's going to kill us. Then it is destroying our species, and we're destroying ourselves. So it's like it's a quantum situation that encoded in the pathology is both the incredible poison and the medicine, and it all is a function of if we actually see what's being revealed to us.
Is this something you would say that we are born with, Paul, or is it an environmental disease because of our upbringing, because of something, the way we live our lives? This is something you attract and it kind of spreads, I think, throughout our own individual system, if you will, as we get older? Or how do you see it, Paul?
I would, you know, it's a very interesting contemplation, because it seems like it's actually part of who we are, and yet it's like the inhuman part of who we are, because it actually informs our inhumanity to our fellow beings. Yet it's actually part of our nature that, you know, in the same way, like, you know, think about the mythology of the Garden of Eden, and, you know, went with Adam and Eve, the snake was already there prior. It wasn't like they first created the snake. That was actually part of the whole environment. In the same way that this evil Watiko, or whatever you would call it, you know, there are a lot of different names for it, that it's sort of like this a priori existent phenomena. And, you know, but the thing which is interesting is that, it's such a hard question to answer, because the thing about this virus, this mind virus, it's like a virus, is that it doesn't actually have any objective existence. In the same way that when you think about, in Tibetan Buddhism, they'll talk about emptiness. They'll say, oh, you know, things don't intrinsically, independently exist, separate from your own mind. Same thing in a dream. The forms of the dream don't exist intrinsically, independently, separate from the consciousness of the dreamer. Same thing with Watiko, that it doesn't exist in an objective form. But if we just think, oh, well, this thing, Watiko, it doesn't exist, then I shouldn't pay any heed to it, then we've fallen under its thrall. But if we think it does exist, and if we think it exists objectively, and then we fight it, then we've fallen under its thrall. So the thing is, the actual built into the phenomena of Watiko, it creates this conundrum in our psyche, because it operates through the psyche. And just even to add one more dimension of just, you know, kind of whatever, just how it's such an interesting phenomena, is that it's the psyche through which we're investigating Watiko, while at the same time Watiko operates through the channel of the psyche. So, like, one, if I can just say really succinctly, because I figured out a really, because people always ask me, well, what is Watiko? And I never know what to say, because it's this trippy phenomena that it doesn't, you know, it's not easy to find words for.
Right.
But in essence, one way of understanding it, it's a form of psychic blindness that not only does it believe itself to be sighted, but arrogantly it imagines itself to be seeing more clearly than anybody else. And that's, in a sense, one way of really describing concisely what Watiko is.
Tell us about the word first. What does that mean, and why did you give it this name?
Yeah. Well, okay. There's a book, Columbus and Other Cannibals, by Forbes, Jack Forbes. And he's this Native American scholar who who just passed away like a number of weeks before my book came out. So I actually, you know, he's the book I've just dedicated to him and his work. And in the book, he actually brings out this term Watiko, which is an indigenous term. You know, the Cree Indians, it's in their language, and it's in depending on the tradition, like it's either called Wendigo or it's just they have all these different names depending on the tribe. But he brings it out in Columbus and Other Cannibals, and he actually translates it into somewhat of a modern idiom as being the psychological disease that, and the current incarnation of it is the multinational corporation, and it's devouring, the indigenous people would call it cannibal sickness, because it's basically, you know, this energy that actually takes over people and they consume. So they'll actually, like, consume, you know, in a way, other people or the environment without taking anything back. And so that's, in a way, you know, and of course, I mean, the whole, in my book, I really unfold more of the etymology and the mythology of the word. But the thing which is interesting about Watiko, I mean, there are so many things. It is the trippiest concept, because when you contemplate it, you see, it's not a personal energy. It's what's called either a transpersonal energy, an archetypal energy, or what's called daimonic energy. And the daimonic is an energy that actually can possess the ego and take one over. And when that happens, one doesn't have any awareness that one is possessed. And then one just becomes an instrument to act out this deeper daimonic energy. And so the thing is that when somebody is in a way kind of taken over by Watiko, they have no idea of their condition. They don't have any awareness of how sick they are. And it's contagious in that, you know, it operates, like I was saying, via the unconscious psyche, but through the blind spot. And a person who's taken over by Watiko, because they're in a way channeling this daimonic energy, they can have like a certain charm or charisma that can easily entrance other people into, you know, their, in a way, archetypal spin or their point of view. So it's very much like some sort of hypnotic, it's like a spell that's mm-hmm. being cast, and it's a collective psychosis. So you see, because of that, you can't even understand Watiko without understanding that there's a non-local field that we're all contained in and that we're actually interconnected in. But the thing which is interesting, because there are so many ways of unfolding this, in that daimonic energy, the word daimon, it actually, the real inner meaning is the guiding spirit or the inner voice. And it's related to hearing a voice, to finding one's calling, one's vocation, to the genius. All of that etymologically has to do with the daimon. And the point is that if we honor that daimonic energy that's within us, that's not, you know, a personal energy, it's a transpersonal archetypal energy, then we actually discover our genius and our true calling and our vocation, and we connect with our inner guidance, and then we're able to channel that daimonic energy constructively in a creative way, and we become, in a way, these artists, you know, and mm-hmm. our canvas is life itself. But if we don't honor that daimonic energy and we turn away from it, that daimonic energy turns negative and becomes a demon. And that's Watiko. You know, and then we become taken over by it, right. And we just become instruments for it, and we act it out unknowing to ourselves. So in a sense, we become these, like, a secret agent, and our secret is secret even to ourselves.
So it's our shadow, maybe, in one sense, we could say. And if we don't recognize that shadow, if we don't learn to work with it, if we suppress it, it turns on us to get our, maybe not more than the attention, of course, but what happens during that transformation? Why does it turn on us, do you think?
Yeah. Well, no, you're totally right on with the shadow, because I in the book I talk about from the psychological point of view, it's encoded in the shadow. And what will happen to the extent that we're not really in touch with our own shadow, of course, then what do? We throw it outside of us, you know, have the projection of the shadow onto someone else. And then, you see, the one way of understanding this is because, okay, and this is important, too, with understanding Watiko, because I was saying you can't really even see it without understanding the field, that there's a non-local field. But then one other way of understanding it, too, is to see that this existence that we're in, it's like we're having a mass shared, like a dream, a mass shared dream, and in which we're all interconnected and characters in each other's dreams. And one way of understanding that, if I'm in a dream, and if I project out my shadow, what's going to happen? Because what is the dream, but it's just a reflection of my own mind. So if I project out my own darkness, what's going to happen to the dream? But instantaneously, in no time whatsoever, it's going to shapeshift and reflect back that darkness that I'm projecting out, because it is nothing other than my own mind. And then if I'm not awake to the projective tendencies of my mind in that I'm in a dream, then I have all the evidence I need that the shadow is then out there, because here's the dream supplying all the evidence that the darkness, that it actually exists in a seeming objective form outside of myself. So then I react to that darkness trying to kill it, because that's actually a reflection of the actual inner impulse, which was the start of the shadow projection in the first place, where I'm actually splitting off from my own shadow and wanting to get rid of it outside of myself. Well, here it is appearing outside of myself, and now I try to kill the shadow, but that actually, by doing that, I'm unwittingly becoming possessed by the very shadow I'm trying to kill. So it's a form of madness. And what I've just described is playing out, you know, in collective form in the greater body politic, and it's nothing other than madness, and it's another way of describing Watiko.
Is the dream, Paula, becoming a nightmare? I mean, the year since you wrote The Madness of George W. Bush, things haven't turn to the better on the mass scale, and anyway, individually people might have been waking up, things might have been happening, you know, under the radar, if you will, but collectively we're in a nightmare right now, aren't we?
Right. No, that is definitely true. But you see, the thing is, you know, one of the dangers is to get into a fixed point of view of just pessimism or despair, and it's really easy when you follow what's happening in the world to just fall into that perspective. But one way of understanding it from the point of view of this being a dream, and I can't emphasize enough how profoundly important it is to really to see things through the dream, like through that lens, is that what you begin to see is, oh, I see, the fact that in a dream that the shadows are so dark and coming out from hiding from the underworld and in the corners and are just right in front of my face and are all over the place, and it seems like things are just getting worse, that shadows, you know, are a function of light. It's an expression that there must be incredible light nearby that's actually bringing forth the shadow. You see, one of the things to understand is that in, you know, the whole idea of, like, enlightenment, which, you know, I mean, I don't know much about that. I'm just like I'm a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, but I'm really a beginner in that way. But what I know from my teachers is that they'll always talk about that it's that enlightenment has to do with making the darkness conscious. Mm-hmm. So you see, one of the ways, and if I can just, you know, contemplate how Watiko works, because you see, the thing about Watiko is that it can't stand to be seen, just like a vampire can't stand the light of day, right? Because when you see Watiko and how it operates through the unconscious, then it's out of business. Then it has, you take away its autonomy and its omnipotence, and then it has no power over you.
It's hiding, you know, within you, in that sense, from the parts of yourself that you refuse to look at. But when you begin to do that, when it has no other way to turn or escape or hide, then you disintegrate it in a way. Is that correct?
Right. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So the thing is that, you know, going back to, like, what my teachers always tell me about, you know, enlightenment, they'll say, yeah, it's making the darkness conscious. It's like, so all of a sudden, you know, people talk about, you know, enlightenment is seeing the light, and yeah, that's one form of it. But another form of enlightenment is seeing the darkness, that it's through the darkness that actually we actually, you know, can actually have the enlightenment and wake up. And, like, one other way of understanding this, because, you know, so what I'm trying to do in my work is that there's just, like, infinite contemplations that are shedding light on Watiko, because what you were saying is exactly it, that when we flood light on the darkness, it has no power over us. So just there are a couple of thoughts. One is, a lot of really well-intentioned spiritual people, like, an example, in the city I live in, there's this metaphysical bookstore. It's the biggest metaphysical bookstore in town, and I give a couple talks there every year for like 20-something years. And when my Huatico book came out, and they were all excited, they set up, you know, a talk for me, a book signing. And then after a week of them having the book, they called me up and they canceled the book signing. And they said, well, actually, if you want to give a talk, you can, but you can't talk about Huatico. They wouldn't allow me to talk about it because they were so freaked out that I was actually trying to illumine evil. And they were like overly identified being this, like, you know, metaphysical new age bookstore.
Right.
We don't want to give any attention to evil. We just want to focus on the light. And I didn't pursue the dialogue because they felt really fixed in their viewpoint. But I was thinking, wow, they don't understand that one of the ways Huatico works, yeah, if you actually just focus on the light and actually are contracting against the darkness out of fear, you know, so you're actually in like an avoidance of the darkness, that's unwittingly feeding the darkness. And so here they were like, you know, consciously thinking, they were so identified with the light, and but by their contraction and being just so afraid of the darkness, they were unwittingly feeding it. So that's a clue. You see, all of these are clues of how to deal with Huatico. Because on one hand, we don't want to too fully just become fascinated with the darkness, because that feeds it. But we don't want to just turn away from it. But it's a third option is to see the darkness, is to actually not look away, but we have to develop a certain strength of self to be able to do that. And then we can choose where we place our attention. Oh, okay, I see you, but do I want to focus my awareness on you, or do I want to just focus my awareness on creating the world I want?
Yeah.
That, you see, that what the thing with Huatico would hate that, because then it just dies because it feeds on our awareness.
You have to be aware of that. Otherwise, you'll be it will trick you, basically. If you don't have an awareness of what it's doing or why it's doing it, what have you, then as you say, we're going to actually enforce it in that sense, because we're, again, if we're scared about, you know, of it, then it still is going to hold, if you will, actually an occult power over us, a hidden power over us that we're not,
exactly.
You know, very,
exactly.
Very too
right,
bad
right,
then
right.
That these people are shying away from that just because it's associated with the things that they don't want to look at. But again, as you said, Paul, that kind of reveals pretty much about the character of the people who run the bookstore, I guess, then.
Yeah, no, well, it's a business, and they're just, you know, trying to make money and all that. No, totally. But the thing that what you just said is so right on, because the thing about this mind virus is it's a trickster, and it works through, like, denial and self-deception. And it's like, you know, when we get, like, a tapeworm in our system, it's very much like that, because the tapeworm, it actually will secrete chemicals so that we start craving food that feeds it.
That's right.
And so, and then more and more as it grows and we're the host, and meanwhile it's killing us. But as it's doing that, it's actually hiding itself, so that, because it operates through our blind spot. And so, I mean, it's really interesting, because even, you know, in my work, because my whole life's work is devoted to, like, flooding light on this particular, you know, you could call it a parasite, a virus, a tapeworm, a vampire. There are all these metaphors, you know, like a demon. There are all these metaphors for it. And I just feel all the time, I mean, I feel it now, that, oh, wow, as we're actually mapping it and illuminating it and pointing at it and tracking it and giving it a name, you know, like in like indigenous cultures and mythology, when you find the name of the demon, you take away its power.
That's right.
Because by finding the name, you actually see it, you know, and not just any name, it has to be the right
name.
The
right name, yes.
You know, and in my book I talk about, well, it's really up to you whether you call it Huatico, malignant egophrenia. In a way, it doesn't make a difference what the name is, as long as the name is like a signifier and actually pointing at this non-local disease, you know, of the psyche, of the soul, that actually, you know, it's exactly what you said. It's a trickster, it shapeshifts, it hides itself, and yet when you see it, when you really see it, then it has no power over us, you know.
A couple of questions on this here, because this is interesting. Is it, well, first of all, actually, we can just talk about if you believe that everyone has it, or is there certain human beings who are psychically immune to this, do you think, Paul?
Right, no, it's really, really important to understand that everyone has it in potential, and because we're all not separate from the field, right? And so in a way, we're like these shamans. We're like these oracles, where if there is an energy that actually is pervasive in the field, you know, that's not separate from us. So say if I'm like this great enlightened practitioner, right? Well, I'm not separate from the whole universe. So, and if I, at a certain moment, fall into an arrogance thinking, oh, well, I'm immune from Wetiko because I'm so enlightened, guess what? That right. thought form is the very way that Wetiko has insinuated itself into my psyche.
The door is open. So, let's go in, yeah.
Right, and so because of that, you know, I mean, it really, it's important to cultivate a sense of humbleness and compassion. And you know, but the thing about Wetiko, I mean, it's an infinite contemplation because it's like, say, think about if it's like a virus, instead of like with a typical virus, you know, it would mutate so that any, you know, attempt we try to heal it, it'll mutate. The thing about Wetiko, it actually forces us to mutate. So it's actually secretly in the service of our evolution. You see, that's what I'm trying to point at, that encoded in the pathology is like it's actually this incredible gift that's showing us the, you know, the dreamlike nature of our situation, the dreamlike nature of ourselves, and actually it's really showing us more and more who we are You see, because when I'll say who we are, what I'm talking about is that the thing about Wetiko, it's showing us that we don't exist as isolated, like, entities that are separate from each other, but that we actually are all parts of the same field, which is to say that we don't exist as these skin-encapsulated egos, and it's Wetiko that's actually the very entity that's, in a way, introducing us to that.
So this might be difficult to answer that in a sense, because it seems to be both, but is it collective, or will it be manifesting itself? And if it is collective, will it manifest itself individually, different for everyone, Paul?
Yeah. No, that's such a great question. I so appreciate that, because it's a total collective phenomenon. We're having this Mashara dream, and we are dreaming up the Wetiko. It's a collective psychic epidemic that, and in which we're destroying ourselves because we don't recognize it, and yet it's manifesting in each of our lives in an individual way. So now, for example, like in my first book, I pointed out with President Bush, like he was so unconsciously taken over by Wetiko, oligonegrophrenia, whatever you would call it, that by, you know, and there are certain people who are so, in a way, possessed and taken over by Wetiko that they don't even know it, that they, in a sense, are the incarnation of this higher dimensional, formless, archetypal, like, bug, you could say. They're actually the actual human, the revelation of it. So what that means is when you see that, so they're like the portal through which that formless, higher dimensional, like, you know, this parasite of the mind is actually kind of coming into our third dimension. But seeing, you know, when you have the recognition, oh, there are certain people who, and you know, and it's important to not concretize anyone because we're all, you know, we all have Buddha nature and all that. But what I'm saying is that at any given point, certain people, in a way, become fully taken over. And so in that moment, it's both horrifying, but it's also like a real, like, this gold mine of information, because they're actually, like, showing us what the actual, like, formless, like I've been saying, higher dimensional bug, what it actually appears like, and how. You see, the thing is, when they're the portal for it, you begin to see, oh, how the field configures itself with reference to them. And one way of understanding this, when there's an abuser, for example, in a family system, and one could say, oh, that abuser, at that moment, they're actually, you know, taken over by the Wetiko virus and incarnating it into the family system. But if you watch what happens, how when you have a figure who's a perpetrator in a family system, the whole field typically configures itself to protect the abuser in a non-local way. And they're not even doing anything, but they're just so, in a way, taken over by the virus that the field, in a way, synchronistically reflects that back. And it was through that in my life, in my family, with my father in particular, he was taken over so fully by Wetiko, and then I began to realize, oh my God, all the relatives, all my friends, the mental health system, they were all, in a way, configuring themselves to actually become in alignment and protect the abuser. And that's how I discovered in my own life this deeper, non-local, underlying field.
I wanted to ask you as well how you see things have progressed since George W. Bush, and how you see that this is inflicting potentially, especially leaders, actually, because in a way we collectively, we project stuff, obviously, upon them, and they are symbolically, you know, in a sense, no matter if we elect them, if we even look away from that process a little bit, we can see that symbolically the leaders reflect our projection nonetheless. They are there for a reason, if I put it that way. So how do you see that people like, you know, Obama or the, you know, the former head of the World Bank, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, there are many examples right out there of our so-called leaders, how that has gone on from George W. Bush hasn't really improved either, has it?
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, because you're tapped into that, you know, like whether it's Bush or Obama or whoever, that from the dreaming point of view, you know, they're like actually just picking up this role that's in the collective psyche and in you know, just deep down in the collective unconscious. So, you know, when you see that, you actually realize, oh wow, they're actually, you know, like some sort of like an embodied reflection of this inner, you know, figure in myself. And you know, so you see, the thing is, it's like it's so crucial that perspective of like actually, you know, seeing the dreaming of it. Because if you don't have the recognition that, like, for example, Obama or Bush or whoever, that if you don't have the recognition, oh, they're actually, you know, we're all dreaming them up into materialization to actually reflect back this kind of, you know, insane part of ourselves. If you don't see that, then you're going to think of them as being separate from yourself. And then you fall under the spell of what he go, and then you're going to be fighting your own projection. And then, you know, by having that state of like where you polarize between a good and a bad and us versus them, that's the signature of Wetiko. So even political activists who are well-intentioned, who are really like fighting the evil in the greater body politic, if they don't have the realization of that we're in a Mashar dream and that who they're fighting is actually their own reflection, even with the best of intentions, political activists could be unwittingly feeding the very evil they're fighting against, you know. So it's because of that that I've coined a phrase that it's really important to combine being a spiritual practitioner and a political activist, and I call it being a spiritually informed political activist. Because even a lot of spiritual people who are incredibly well-intentioned and are sitting doing meditation and chanting their mantras and thinking, oh, well, if I get myself in order, well, then the whole world will reflect that. That's true on one level, and it's not true on another. Because if they don't realize the dream, they don't realize their inner process is manifesting in the outer world. And the way to work on your inner process is to fully engage in the outer world, you know. And so the idea of being a spiritual practitioner, so the spiritual practitioner who's just focusing on themselves and not having the recognition that the outer world is their inner process. And what I'm describing is a dream. Because what is a dream? When you're in a dream and you actually have the lucidity, what do you recognize? You see that the seemingly outer dreamscape is actually just, it's not separate from your inner psyche. That the inner is the outer. You know? So spiritual practitioners who are just absorbed in their practice and not recognizing that the outer world is the very medium through which they can work on themselves, they're just they're absorbed in their own narcissism. So what I'm pointing at is that you have to, in a way, cross-pollinate a spiritual practitioner and a political activist.
Yep, I agree. The traits of both worlds, you need everything. You need a holistic approach to both understand yourself and the world around you, because, again, they have there's a relationship between them, and everything can send you hints, if you will, of a larger or bigger understanding about them. I wanted to ask you about the traits of Wetiko as well. If we can diagnose it, you know, in other people, if we can diagnose it in ourselves, this is interesting, I think.
Yeah, totally. And in my book, I actually go through that. And, you know, I mean, there are definitely traits. And, you know, on the one hand, they're like, you know, I mean, and keep in mind, we all, you know, we all have Wetiko at each or any moment or not. So the whole tricky thing, it's a whole different form of diagnosis, because it's not like, oh, they have it and we don't. If we think that, if we actually see in that way, then we at that moment have fallen under its spell and we ourselves have Wetiko. But you know, there are certain people, like I was saying with Bush or whoever, that are so fully taken over by it that they'll embody particular qualities. And the qualities are such, like, examples would be like malignant narcissism. And from the mythic point of view, there's the myth of, like, the negative father, which has to do with, you know, power and domination over others. And, you know, just being disassociated from the heart and from eros and from feeling and from relatedness, stuff like that. And then there's an arrogance because, you know, what happens in full-blown Wathikoism is that because of the projective tendencies of the mind, we actually become bewitched by our own projections. So in a way, a full-blown Wathiko, somebody at a given moment who's really taken over, in a way they're in like an inverted world where they're actually thinking that what they're perceiving, you know, on the inkblot of the world objectively exists. And then they react to it as if it objectively exists without having the recognition that what they're actually reacting to is their own projection, their own mind. And in a way, who among us hasn't fallen prey to that one on any given, you know, day or something like that? So you see, what I'm trying to point out is that, yeah, it's an incredible pathology that is destroying our species potentially, yet it's something that's informing all of us that we all have at each and any moment. And when you begin to see that, the seeing of it, and particularly not just when one person sees it, but when one person sees it and really stabilizes that realization, which is exactly like being in a dream and having the recognition of the nature of the dream and stabilizing that lucidity and then connecting with other people in that dream who also are seeing the nature of their situation and are actually becoming lucid and connecting with other people who are having that same realization. And then when you put your contemplation together, and, you know, I'm just invoking the imagination, because keep in mind, Wathiko works through the imagination, in that our imagination is, like, tied into, like, you know, this sacred divine energy. It's actually where we're co-dreaming and co-creating our universe every moment. But Wathiko will affect our imagination and make us think that, oh, our imagination is nothing. It's not real. We don't have any influence. And then, of course, if we hold that point of view, being that where our imagination is divine, the whole dream verse, the whole universe, the waking dream, will reflect back, oh, well, clearly our imagination isn't important. It'll just reflect back the whole, you know, point of that whole thought form of, oh, the imagination isn't potent, is from the imagination. It's actually showing us the profundity of the imagination. It's very, very, it's like this rabbit hole that you go down and you can discover, you can unlock, oh my God, our real power is in our dreaming, is in our sacred imagination, and that's the very thing that the Wathiko bug, in a way, sort of disables.
So how belief-driven is it, do you think? If we talk about belief in what reality is, for instance, we are getting schooled in certain science, there is other, obviously, science out there that shows the alternative or the other side, quantum science or things like Rupert Sheldrake about the non-local field and the morphogenetic field, a whole lot of stuff out there that are really interesting, right, when it comes to science. But if we look at the official science that is out there, it shows us that, I don't even know if they don't recognize that there is a soul, right? Things are just externally driven. This is objective reality. Right. This is it. So if most people are in that kind of belief system, Paul, wouldn't that be a perfect kind of breeding ground for something like this to hide itself in then?
That's exactly it. The Wathiko bug, it institutionalizes itself. It incorporates itself through the academy, you know, through the accepted belief system. And then, you know, people who are part of the culture who are, you know, get entrained or entranced into this fixed point of view in which they believe, you know, sort of this classical, like the mechanistic scientific point of view of the world, and then they unwittingly, you know, become card-carrying members of Wathiko, and all the while they think they're, you know, these modern, these really sophisticated, these civilized beings, and yet, to the extent that they don't see the actual, like, the nature of the dream, and keep in mind, when I'll say the nature of the dream, I'm talking about that there's no, you know, I mean, in quantum physics, with the observer effect, they've actually shown, oh, it's nonsense to talk about. You can't, it makes no sense at all to talk about an objective world. Mm. And it makes no sense at all to talk about an independent observer who's separate from the objective world. But in our culture and with the academy, we've been hypnotized into thinking, oh, yes, this is an objective world. It exists in a certain way. There are certain things that are possible, certain things that are impossible. And that actually, in a way, conditions our thinking. And it conditions what we're supposed to not think about. And it conditions our belief. In a way, it conditions our mind. And so in a way, to the extent that we haven't like snapped out of the collective spell, because keep in mind, Watiko is a psychic epidemic. It's a collective psychosis. It's a collective spell. It's exactly like being in a fairy tale, and there's a spell that's befallen our whole planet, you know? And it's super important for people who are actually beginning to wake up to actually, you know, try and just to broadcast or in whatever creative way, you know, to actually transmit in a way that can be helpful and skillful to people, to help people to snap out of, because the thing about Watiko, which is so interesting, there might be these externalized agencies like the mainstream media, the propaganda machine, who are, you know, kind of entrancing us into a particular very limited point of view that's of the nature of the spell. But at a certain point, once we internalize it, they don't even have to do anything, because then we've internalized our own spellcasting, and we become our own police state, and we become our own control system, you know? And so because of that, it's incredibly important, you know, to connect with other people. It's the idea in Buddhism, they talk about the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the teacher, the teaching, and the community of fellow awakening beings. The Sangha, the community, it's incredibly important that when you hang out with other people who are also awakening, it's contagious. You know, it helps your awakening, and then it helps, you know, so it becomes, mm-hmm. in a way, this field that actually, in a way, can spread and be an antivirus for the virus of Watiko.
Right, that's the word I wanted to kind of get to use, I guess, so that people can install a firewall of sorts in their mind to begin, at least. So you don't spot everything, maybe, you don't see everything all at once, but it's at least an ability to have your awareness there to understand what goes in and out of your mind. It's like a conscious observer, if you will, of what is happening. It's not just an unconscious process where you end up in front of the TV after, you know, a day at your job, not doing anything, and just, you know, being programmed by the mainstream news, if you know what I mean. So
yeah, no, totally. I mean, what you're pointing at, I mean, is so right on, because in Tibetan Buddhism, they'll talk about developing like mindfulness. And in when you really, you know, study the teachings, that's, in a way, that's like their real, like, technique for being the guardian against Watiko. And they'll call it the evil one. Mara is the actual name. And they'll say, yeah, when you develop mindfulness, that's actually like this guardian at the gate to stop, you know, that, you know, the energy of Mara and his forces from coming in and like, you know, steering you off course. But the thing which is interesting about Mara, so here, you know, here's the in the whole mythology of the Buddha, who is sitting under the Bodhi tree right before he became enlightened, right? And that's when the forces of Mara came and were trying to, you know, like distract him and mess with him and all that stuff. And so from one point of view, oh yeah, these forces of Mara, they're the ones who are trying to keep us from enlightenment and all that. But when you realize the dreaming nature, so here Buddha basically was having a dream, and who is Mara but actual energies in his own mind? And without Mara's appearance, Buddha would not have developed the muscle of realization to attain enlightenment.
Right.
So secretly, Mara was an ally. You see, so it's important, you know, to not demonize and say, oh, Watiko is just this, or people who are like, you know, taken over by what, because if we see somebody taken over by Watiko, and if we just concretize them and demonize them, Well, at that moment, we ourselves have fallen under a Watiko because we're actually doing the very thing we're accusing them of doing, because somebody who's fallen under the spell of Watiko is projecting the shadow, and that whole dynamic then takes over their being. But if we then concretize them as, oh, they have Watiko and we don't, we then unwittingly are doing the very thing that we're accusing them of. So you see, it's so interesting because you always have to, at every moment, cultivate that sense of mindfulness and that the humbleness, you know, and that's in a way, and the compassion, because compassion, and I'm not talking idiot compassion. In Buddhism, they'll talk about idiot compassion of just being smiley-faced, and, oh, I just love everyone, because sometimes compassion can be really fierce and can set a boundary and can say no.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but compassion comes out of the experience when you're in a dream and you realize the nature of the dream and you have the realization, oh, my God, all the characters in the dream are actually aspects of me. There's no separation. The energetic expression of that realization is compassion. And that means even the bankers and the worst Watikos are actually not separate from myself. And then you can actually have compassion. And that's the real protection against Watiko.
The shadow, the evil one, or Mara, as you just made an example of here, in a way, then, is the incentive, if you will, for us to actually evolve, to try harder, to reach a new level where we haven't been before. Otherwise, frankly, in a sense, we might just sit around on our ass all day and get nowhere, right? Because there's nothing, no reason for us to do that. Everything is good and dandy, right? So, yeah.
Jung calls Satan the godfather of humanity. You know, and what he's pointing at is that when you have an energy, an evil energy, whether you call it Satan, Mara, all these, you know, it's thousands of names, but it actually, so on one level, yeah, they seem to embody this, like, evil, and not even personal evil, but archetypal evil, absolute evil, but, you know, because in, you know, to understand Watiko, you really have to shed light on the darkness. You have to have that courage to really come to terms with that darkness, and it's actually within yourself, and you discover, oh, wow, you know, it's actually the catalyst. It's inspiring me to evolve. It's actually, in a way, forcing me to expand my consciousness in a way that I wouldn't have without its appearance on the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Yeah,
that's why this is important. And again, we're back to that point you raised earlier, Paul, that we have to have, as you said, courage to shine a light on the darkness, and also understand that both components are part of the creation here. We cannot exclude one part, then we're missing half of the picture, because both of these two entities are those who are creating, in my view, in a way, the conditions for life. This is how we begin to operate. This is how, actually, if you look at most things in nature and what we know about the universe around us, you have this tug of war kind of thing scenario going on. And this is what, kind of, if you believe in evolution or microevolution, what have you, that's what we see witnessing there, at least, that there's a reason for why these different species are at each other now and then, and this forces them to evolve, as we talked about, and to go into new places, basically. And that's why you can't exclude one part of it and think you're going to progress forward. You're just going to fall back, I think, if you do that.
Yeah, no, to exclude any part of you know, the totality is to actually, like, avoid being, you know, having a relationship with parts of ourselves. And the thing about Watiko is that it feeds on that fragmentation, on that disassociation, to the extent that we're not, like, really having an embracing attitude towards who we are and towards who, you know, I mean, who we are is actually a reflection and reflected through the macrocosm of the world. To the extent that we polarize or split from a part of ourselves or project the shadow or in any way have any fragmentation, that's in a way the open doorway for Watiko to insinuate itself, you know, into our minds. And now keep in mind, to think about, you see, the thing which makes Watiko in a way really, really, you know, hard to discover is that it flavors our perception. So it'll actually, you know, as we're actually contemplating it or trying to find it, it's like the lens through which we're looking through. And if we don't see that, then we're just going to deceive ourselves. Because one thing that Watiko really teaches you or teaches us is the incredible capacity that our species has to deceive ourselves. you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of why when people, because I work with so many people and they'll say, wow, I feel really bad. I don't trust myself. I realize I can't trust my perception because I see, my God, I can deceive myself at any moment. And I'll typically say something like, well, that's the beginning of wisdom. That's when you're first beginning to realize the real nature of Watiko and of yourself. And, you know, and one other way of saying that is, yeah, any of us can fall into our unconscious and act out at any point. You know, and that's, in a way, one other way of describing Watiko is that when any of us, you know, to the extent that we're in trauma, what happens in trauma is, like, we have the whole, like, compulsion to repeat the trauma. So what we don't remember, we enact,
yes,
you know,
yes,
and we'll play out and we'll act out. And, but the thing is, because Watiko is actually very related to trauma, and so when we're traumatized, our like attempts to heal the trauma are somehow the very thing which is creating the very seeming problem that we're trying to heal in this like infinitely self-perpetuating feedback loop. And so because of that, we're actually like acting out our unconscious in a way that's actually feeding the very source of, which is the root of the unconscious pathology. But the thing is, encoded in that, we're trying to complete something. In that repetition compulsion, something is trying to be like decoded or like to liberate something. But if we don't recognize the deeper process that we're playing out, we're just going to endlessly, it's the very thing which informs addictions, you know? And so what I'm saying is that the thing with the Watiko, it's completely related to trauma, to addictions, to like, you know, unconsciously acting out. And who among us doesn't do this? We all do this. Mm. But when you begin to discover that the doing of that is somehow the medium through which we can discover that what's actually underlying that. And even if I can just, you know, enlarge the scope of a contemplation for a second, right now in the greater body politic, we're actually, in a way, we're actually enacting a suicide ritual. We're killing ourselves as a species. We're actually, you know, destroying the biosphere, and we're destroying each other and ourselves, right? But when you actually connect with the deeper dreaming point of view, you discover, oh, wow, how come we're doing that? Well, clearly we're a species gone mad. Clearly we're collectively in a collective psychosis. But us doing that is the very way we're actually discovering how not to do that, which we clearly haven't learned, or we wouldn't be doing it.
That's right.
And then it becomes a question of, do we actually have the recognition of what's being revealed through our unconscious acting out, in which case we wake up, and the whole thing was inspired by Watiko. So then, is Watiko evil, or is it like an incredible gift from like the most highest divine? But if we don't recognize what's being revealed, we destroy ourselves.
And I think that if we had that answer, Paul, if we could put it in that category, it would stop. It wouldn't have the same effect upon us, because then we could either categorize it as evil or good, what have you. We could be comfortable, lay back, and that was it. But that's not how it works. That's not how it operates. It's a constantly elusive force, and we're not meant to be able to nail it down, pin it down, if you will, because if we could, it would lose its potency, I think.
Yeah. And no, definitely. And I keep on having the image as we're talking of like the crucifix, because from the dreaming point of view, when you see Christ and the whole Christ event and the crucifixion symbolically, I mean, it's really like teaching us something. And for me, it's particularly having to do with, you know, the tension of the opposites. Like, think about the cross, and here's Christ, who's actually, he's consciously holding the tension of the opposites. He's not just identifying prematurely with one of the opposites and projecting out the other, you know, in which case you develop like a symptom, mm-hmm, or a disease, but he's holding that tension, and it's excruciating. It's a veritable crucifixion experience. It's an agony. It's a passion play. And yet out of that comes the resurrected body, you know, which is a, you could say symbolically is grace, or, you know, the transcendent function, mm-hmm, is the term that Jung uses, the reconciling symbol, something that we couldn't have thought of by, you know, by our own egoic selves. And the point is that, you know, the imitation of Christ, we all are Christ on the cross, and to the extent we're able to, in a way, create that alchemical vessel, the hermetically sealed vessel, where our, you know, the projections don't leak out, and we're actually just holding that incredible, because in the hermetic vessel of alchemy, there has to be incredible pressure in that vessel for the prima materia, which is like the darkness and the raw material out of which the gold is made. And so in a way, we're all kind of, you see, and I talk about this in my book, that it's like God is incarnating, but not like it did 2,000 years ago through one person, i.e. Christ, mm-hmm. but it's incarnating through all of humanity. We're all getting drafted into this divine cosmic drama of incarnation, and it's incarnating through earthly human beings, where Christ, he was completely pure and white and, you know, and light, where like the dark part of totality was split off, when you look at it as a dreaming process, in the figure of Satan. Right? They're
right.
The opposites, totally polarized. There's Satan, there's Christ. Christ was totally light. Well, now God is incarnating through all of humanity, through you and me and all of us, and we're these earthly beings who have a shadow. And that, you see, but the thing is, when there's light that's coming into a dream, the shadow becomes more and more visible. So what I'm actually pointing at now is the deeper sort of cosmic, sort of mythological aspect of how to contextualize the Watiko epidemic, that it's actually that we are getting enlisted into a divine drama of incarnation, where the dark god, you know, this mythic term, is actually, you know, more and more showing itself so as to be actually assimilated into our wholeness. Into who we are.
That's right. That's a very good point, too. The brighter you make the light, or the more you turn up the light, if you will, the more you actually have the ability to see the shadow. And I think that's a really good point. I think that's what's happening in our world right now as well, Paul. That's why we see so much shit, sorry for the word, out there right now, because this is what's happening. This is an ongoing process, which means as well then that that's actually a positive turn at the end, because it's not until you actually can see and recognize something that you have the opportunity to do something about it, or to change it if you don't like it, that is. So
And if I could just say one thing,
sure,
about that,
go ahead.
What you just said was so interesting. You know, I keep on going back to, from the dreaming point of view, but which actually has to do with just the reality level, with the true nature state. When I'm unconscious of something, right, say I'm just unconsciously, you know, I have an identification with something, so I can't see it because I'm identical with it, how do I become conscious of it? Well, I project it out, I first dream it up into objectified form. I mean, just think about a dream. You're unconscious of something, so you actually dream it up into the dream, and it'll so it always appears outside of ourselves at first. Right, and then like I was saying before with the shadow projection, you know, if we don't have the recognition that it's our own energy, we just react to it. But when we actually simply just have the recognition, oh, I'm looking in a mirror, and etymologically the word mirror actually means shadow holder, okay? So the whole idea is that our unconscious always approaches us from outside of ourselves. And so in my book I talk about, yeah, the unconscious is coming. We are, the unconscious is manifesting via the outside world. One other way of saying that is that our inner process is actually manifesting as the outer body politic. And to recognize that, that's to have an expansion of consciousness. And when one has that and is able to stabilize that, because it's not hard to have that expansion of consciousness for a moment, in the same way that just in, like in a dream, you can have lucidity for a moment, but then it's pretty easy to just fall back asleep and get absorbed back into the forms of the dream. The point is to stabilize that lucidity, and then to have everything that manifests in the dream be a stimulator to even more increase the lucidity, to the point when you really stabilize that, and particularly when you hang out with other people who are doing the same practice, you create this incredible, like this stable field of lucid awareness that then non-locally just in a way extends itself throughout the entire universe.
Very good. Very interesting as well. Paul, we're going to continue carrying on with you in the next segment. I think we have lots more to talk about and a lot more to cover, of course, as well, both things that are in your new book, Watiko, and some of the other previous work as well, and where you're kind of heading next, I guess. But why don't we talk a little bit about your website first, though, and give people some idea here about where they can go to pick up a copy of the book, and what they can... give us your website first, Paul. We'll begin there.
Sure. Okay. It's, you know, www.awakeninthedream.com. And on the website, there's a ton of articles. They're all free. you know, because I just want people to read this stuff. It's really, I feel, my own personal bias is that it's really important information. And then right on the website is the book Huatico, and you can just order it. You know, I mean, I have lots of copies in my home. I'll just send them out to you, you know, and yeah, it's really easy to order. And that's it. Just www.awakeninthedream.com.
Very good. You have some great articles up there as well, including some of the first one. Remember, we linked those up. That was years ago now, but War on Consciousness and some of these. They're great stuff to read through. And yeah, very important, I feel, as well. And as I said, Paul, we have much more to talk about. So in the meantime here, then, we'll relay people further to awakeninthedream.com and read more about Huatico right there on the website. Stay with us, Paul. We'll be right back with more after this break. the second hour, our continuation with Paul Levy, in our member section, we begin to talk about the role of the shaman, the eradication of them, and how they are now emerging again in a new form. We discuss the question of origin. Where did Wetiko come from? How did it all get started? We also talk about synchronicity, dream symbolism, and our collective psychosis. Later, we discuss archetypes, archetypal energy, the shadow, our concept of evil as being something within us, not outside of us. Most people project their own shadow onto people and onto the world. This takes us into the topic of power-hungry, corrupt people. We can have an understanding of the importance to dethrone individuals that are not healthy to have in positions of power. But will there not be another person ready to take on that position again? There are millions of people out there ready to ascend, like scum to the surface, to positions of power. The question is then, what can be done about it? How do we stop it permanently? Where is the action needed? Paul shares his opinion on this. Get full access to Red Eyes Creations and enjoy all our radio programs, both segments, going back to 2006. Subscribe. We also have much more in our member section. Read more about it on the website, redeyescreations.com. It's easy and quick to subscribe. All right, let's see. Who do we have next on Red Eyes Radio? Laird Scranton, James Gilliland. And then we have our program with Carl Munk coming up as well. Thank you for your patience on that. Also, David Icke, Dean Clifford, Robert Schock, Håkan Blomqvist, Desiree and J.J. Hurtak, and Mike Cross, to name a few. Members, subscribe to our RSS feed with both hours for your convenience. Every 2 months, we create a new file, so return through the members' RSS page to subscribe to the latest files. More with Paul Levy coming up right now. Thank you for listening.